Our guest today, Stephen Isserlis, a remarkable cellist, teacher, musicologist, and most recently an author of children's books. He is descended from a stellar family of musicians, from Felix Mendelssohn down to his grandfather, Russian pianist and composer Julian Isserlis. He is committed to finding and performing rarely heard works, which he programs regularly on his extensive concert schedule. He will be sharing the spotlight in concert with good friend pianist Stephen Huff here in Philadelphia on April 13th at the Perlman Theater at the Kimmel Center. Welcome, Stephen Isserlis. We are so delighted to have you here today. You are an artist of tremendous distinction. And, of course, in the UK, you have won all kinds of things. Tell me, is CBE, is that a knighthood?
No, it's that's not. KBE.
That's KBE. What is a CBE?
Commander of the British Empire.
And what does that mean?
Not a lot. It once meant, after I got the award, my son was being a pain. So I said to him, I command you to do this. And he burst into tears and said, that's not fair, and I've never done it again.
But this is, of course, a great honor, I imagine. And you won the Piatigorsky Award in the United States in 1993, a Schumann Prize for the city of Zwickau. I did my homework. That was Schumann's birthplace.
That's right.
Yeah. So what did that entitle you to, the key to the city?
No, I just had to go, and there was two of us getting that prize at the same time, a Russian musicologist who's a Schumann specialist and me. We were serenaded by these schoolgirls singing everything from memory, choral music by Schumann. And there was some dinner, which wasn't very good, but it was nice. The only thing was it was in the morning, I suppose, the ceremony. And the next morning, I had a live broadcast with the pianist Stephen Huff. We were giving a recital.
Brilliant, brilliant.
Yeah, one of my best friends.
Yes, wonderful.
It was a live broadcast on the BBC from the Aldborough Festival. You know, it was a big concert. And I had this taxi driver pick me up. And it was to his local airport. He didn't know the way, and he got lost, and I missed the flight. And I was only getting there in the evening anyway. And eventually, I got to Aldbury about 10 or 11 at night, and the sound check first thing in the morning. So it slightly tarnished my memory of Zwickau, but I was very pleased to get
it. Well, you were, of course, there's some very, very brilliant musicians who have received that prize as well. I think Emil Gilels, and one of your favorites, Fischer Dieskau, did get it.
Yes.
You want to play like Fischer Dieskau?
Well, I didn't say that. I did once say, as a little soundbite, I said, my ambition is not to be the Pavarotti of the cello, it's to be the Fischer Dieskau of the cello. Yeah, it was just a neat little soundbite.
Well, he was very wonderful and very, tame, technically superb.
Tame, but he was...
He looked
inside the music.
Right.
He wasn't somebody who would sing in a stadium. That's not what he was about.
I wonder if Pavarotti really, when he was beginning...
Yeah, it's not really meant as a criticism of Pavarotti. It's just, if Pavarotti sings, you have to hire a stadium and have live TV and everything. Whereas when Fischer Dieskau, the only time I heard him, one of the few times I heard him live, was in the Queen Elizabeth Hall in London, which is not a huge hall. And we just got drawn into him.
Yes.
This Schumann
leader
recital.
Yes,
and it was wonderful. And that's how I first heard Schumann and Schubert leader.
Yes.
Not that I'm particularly knowledgeable about them, but, I love them. Anyway, it was just a little soundbite thing
and
to say.
And emotionally, I guess, that touches you, the music. Now, are you really related to Felix Mendelssohn?
And Karl Marx and Helena Rubinstein.
Really?
They're all on the family tree. I couldn't tell you my exact relationship to them, but...
That is really fantastic. Brilliant in every field, right?
I wish I were. I can't say I'm very brilliant at perfumes. That's not quite my thing. Nor am I a communist. It's just nice to have those name drops on my family tree.
Well, successful, giants in their field, I guess.
Yes.
Whatever.
Yes. I suppose they're responsible for some not such good things, I suppose, Mr. Marx.
But, yes, well.
It's true, I suppose I would rather be related to Harpo Marx. But Karl Marx was a brilliant thinker. And, I used to know Harpo Marx's son.
Really?
He wrote a piece for me for cello and harp.
And you loved Harpo.
I love Harpo.
What was it that you loved about Harpo?
He's a free spirit. I love that.
But he was brilliant. The three of them were.
They were brilliant.
And I think that he used the harp as a gimmick for their vaudeville act.
But he was very serious about it as well. I like that, the fact, the action quietens down and you have this harp solo.
Now, I don't I don't think he read music, if I
No, that's right, he didn't.
Very interesting, yeah. Mm. So once again, Harpo is your idol. You know, this book that you wrote, Why Beethoven Threw the Stew, is really quite delightful. What Thank inspired you. You to write that?
My son, really. Well, my son, to my great delight, loves classical music and has always done. But so when he was getting to an age where he was beginning to enjoy reading, so about 9 years old, I wanted to buy him a book about music, and there's actually incredibly little there. And since writing had always been what I would have liked to have done if I had not been a cellist, I just sat down and kind of just on spec wrote a chapter about Beethoven. And we sent it to a publisher who said, no, thank you. And we sent it to another publisher who said, yes, please. And then I was kind of inspired and I wrote 5 more chapters. And that's how the book came into being. But it was really just something to read to my son.
Well, you answered a question I was going to ask you about. Do you think you wanted to be a writer if you weren't a cellist? And of course, because you did a documentary as well, didn't you? Schumann.
Yes, that's a television. But I didn't write that. Really, I wrote a little bit of it, but basically mm-hmm. it was. But I did also write. That's right. I co-wrote with an actor called Gabriel Wolfe. We co-wrote an evening of words and music about Schumann. I just love writing. I've always loved writing. At school, you know, the only subject that really interested me was English. That includes music, because I was bored in the music
really?
Lessons. Because of the way it was taught. But I always loved English, and I still do. You know, reading is my favorite hobby.
Well, you're very inquisitive, and I wanted to ask you a very prosaic question. When you started, you were very, very young with the cello, and of course you came from a family of musicians, so that kind of follows. I find that many musicians' children do become interested in music.
Yes, same with the acting profession.
Yes, and you studied with this, is it Jane Cowan?
Cowan, that's right.
And I kind of visualize you, you know, like you would feed a child and you feed them and they won't eat and you tell them stories and they open their mouth. And well, did she do that with her little anecdotes about
musicians?
I suppose.
I mean, it wasn't that I wouldn't open my mouth musically, but she certainly made the composers come to life for me. And that made, in turn, their music come to life. And it made me appreciate the jokes in music, for instance. I mean, there's so much humor in Beethoven or, you know, or Bach or whatever. All the great composers have humor, except possibly Wagner, but he doesn't concern me, luckily. Treating them as friends, as opposed to kind of, you know, these distant figures who one had to respect or else not respect, as the case may be, being on the teacher. But she really made me feel that I knew something about these composers. I could understand what they were saying. She just had this way of bringing the music to life.
And she was, where did you study with her?
In London for a bit, and then in Scotland for a couple of years, in a tiny village in Scotland with about 10 inhabitants and a cello school.
Really? And then what happened?
I came out to the States, to Oberlin College. Going to go to Piatigorsky to study. And he died just that summer. So I was kind of foundering a bit. I got all this money ready to come out to Los Angeles. Nowhere to go. I didn't know what to do. So my great friend, who's a wonderful cello teacher, a professor at Eastman School of Music, Stephen Doan, who I'd invited to come and study with Jane Cowan, he then arranged for me to go and study with his teacher, Richard Kapuscinski, at Oberlin College. And that's what happened. So I spent 2 years at Oberlin, my first ever trip to the States. And then I stopped studying at the age of 19 and went home and waited for the phone to ring, which it eventually did when I was about 30. It was a long wait.
Did you do freelance, you know, section playing?
No, I didn't do that. I refused to do that. But I was living at one stage on about literally $10 a week for food.
Oh, my. A struggling musician.
No, but I wasn't going to do sessions because I knew once I got into that world, I'd never get out of it.
So you always wanted to be a soloist.
And chamber musician.
Musician. And you've organized a number of chamber series, haven't you?
Yes, I continue to do so. I don't separate in my mind really between concertos, recitals, and chamber music. It's all the same.
Is it?
It is. For me, playing concerto is a chamber music experience. You know, I'm very conscious of responding to the way people play their solos. So it's all chamber music. I would be very bored if I was to go around the world playing
as a soloist.
Without listening, you know, playing exactly the same performance in different places. That's not how it should be, I feel.
So, Stephen, what's next?
Well, I've got a recital tour with Stephen Huff, which I'm looking forward to, because as I say, he's one of my best friends.
And an outstanding pianist.
He's great.
I just wonder about some of the great talents that we have around that are, you know, they're kind of recognized, but they're not really, really recognized the way they should be.
Oh, he's doing very well now.
Yes.
Increasingly.
Yes.
He's fine. You don't have to worry about him.
I'm not.
Yeah, he's great. But what else am I doing? Yeah, I'm doing a lot in North America.
Any new recordings on the scene?
Well, Stephen and I are going to record the Brahms sonatas, which actually was my first recording 20 years ago, which dates me. That's kind of how things somewhat started for me. At the age of 25.
So what happened? You starved from 19 until 25?
I went on starving, and that, you know, you make a recording and people notice and it's nice, and it takes a long time for it actually to bear fruit in terms of engagements. I've played with my first professional, you know, fully professional American orchestra, I think, when I was 30, I think it was.
But that's,
in Minnesota.
That's really quite heroic, I mean, to kind of hold out that way.
Well, I'm slightly dramatizing. I wasn't starving.
Well, no,
my parents wouldn't have let me starve.
No, what I mean is you said I want to play chamber music or do, you know, whatever solo work, and I will not go out there and, you know, beat the bushes to get jobs and play, you know, I mean, like, as most musicians do, unfortunately.
Well, but they get arrested if they beat the bushes at the moment.
But in a sense, I mean, that really took a lot of determination.
I suppose. I mean, I just knew I was wanted to beat my own drum, and I still do, you know, and I will not. I mean, I have to say, especially in the recording world, I turn down much more than I accept, because I don't want to become a jobbing cellist. It's not a job.
No, I can only,
especially in the field of, well, everything, but I suppose especially in the field of recording, I don't want to do something unless I truly believe in it.
And, of course, you champion a lot of new works, don't
yes,
you?
Yes, and unusual old works as well. I love doing that.
Unearthing manuscripts
yes,
and so on.
Yes, I love doing that, writing away to libraries, and then finally this package arrives.
What's the process? How does that start?
Well, you just find out where the work is.
You know that there is an existing work
well,
that nobody's
catalogs,
done.
Well, you look at catalogs. You know, you're right. I mean, I have a lot. I have a big music book library at home, so I'll look at the works list, or else I'll look in Groves, the works list, think, hang on, I've never seen that piece. And then you kind of do a little research, where might it be? And if you find it's a library, you write to the library and say, can I have it? And usually, you know, libraries are very good, they'll let you buy copies. And then suddenly you have this piece that hasn't been played for 100 years or whatever. It's great, because it's like the composer's talking directly to you. See his handwriting.
Yes.
I think he's spent at least several hours on this piece. You know, this is a great composer. I'm sure it's worth it. And usually it is worth it.
And you get a good reaction from these newfound works.
Usually. I mean, yeah, I've done first recordings of pieces by Fauré and I think Saint-Saëns and Liszt.
Fauré is one of your favorites.
I loved Fauré. I adore him, yes.
Why?
Why?
Tell me.
Why do I like all my best friends? I just love his music. There's such purity in his
music.
There's such
yeah.
sheer beauty. It's such ecstatic music.
And again, subtle, too.
Very subtle.
A lot of subtlety.
But it's true. You're never going to get a standing ovation by playing a Fauré sonata. And that almost attracts me to it more, in a way. It's just, you've got to draw people into your world. You can't push Fauré out of them. You've got to bring them into his world, which is a very special world. And that's a challenge I relish.
And, of course, in this day and age, when everything is so big and so sensational,
exactly.
You are very special and unusual in that way, that this is what you are determined to remain that way.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not. Fauré is very special.
No,
you
I don't mean
can't.
Fauré. I mean, in general, your
I
whole
see.
Approach
but, I mean,
to music
all the music,
is,
you know, I just
yes.
don't think you can get inside music by deciding what sort of effect it will make and what you can do with it. That's not what it's about. It's, you know, the music is there and you have to approach it. You can't kind of twist it to your own ends.
In terms of your technique and the sound that you were looking for when you said you wanted to study with Piotr Gorsky, in terms of playing the cello, what were you looking for?
From him, I guess I was just very attracted to his personality. He was a
wonderful, warm, charming
Russian bear. Yeah, incredibly charming. And very good sign is that his children adored him, because I know his daughter quite well.
She's
lovely. She's wonderful. And she adored him. And that's always a good sign, because some of these supposedly great men are actually awful to their families.
No, they're self-involved.
Exactly. And they may be philanthropic and make great speeches and things, but if they're not good to their families, then I think they're not great men or women.
You have a family as well. How many children do you have?
Only one that I know of.
Okay, we'll let you go on that one. Gabriel.
Gabriel, how do you know that? Yes,
well, I read it somewhere.
Of course, yes. Of course. Named partly after Gabriel Fauré, of course.
Yes, well, you must love his music very much.
I do, and so does Gabriel, which is nice.
Is he musically inclined?
He's very musical. I mean, he's not serious. He plays the cello, but he's not a serious cellist, but he loves music, and he'll do his homework listening to the Dvorak cello concerto, or, you know, and he goes on these orchestral courses and falls in love with the pieces he plays there. Insists on listening, which is great. I must say, it gives me great delight that my son is sitting there listening to music that I love too.
Now, you do a great deal of touring, don't you?
I do.
How many weeks out of the year?
I would say about 7 or 8 months of the year, I'm aware.
That's a lot.
That is a lot.
Yeah. All over.
Pretty
much the United States.
The English-speaking Union. I've never been to Africa, the continent of Africa, at all.
How about the Far East?
Yeah, I go fairly regularly to Japan and Korea and Taiwan. I just went to Taiwan for the first time, where I had a much nicer experience than Elton John. My gallerist had a miserable time in Taiwan.
Right.
But
well, I'm sure you present yourself a little differently than he does.
Actually, I met him once. He was really nice. I really liked him.
Have you ever done anything offbeat, playing any music?
No. I mean, I have to say, despite the title of this program, crossover is a bit of anathema for me, in that when it involves people doing what they're not good at, and I think that's a lot of crossover, is that. I do play the Beatles songs in arrangements by my sister, and that's because I grew up with the Beatles as much as I grew up with classical music. That's the only pop music I just loved. I mean, you know, from age three. I adored it. And one of the great days of my life was when I spent 2 hours with Paul McCartney.
Oh, my.
And I played Beatles songs to him. And at one point, he said, I've got to get on the drums. So we actually played
where
together.
Where was this?
A few years ago. It was his studio. I'd done a favor for a friend of mine who's a fantastic composer, in fact, David Matthews. And David Matthews was working with Paul on one of his classical pieces. And so, as to return the favor to me, he knew I was dying to meet, you know, Paul McCartney, and so he took me along, and it was a great success. We were meant to stay for about half an hour, and we stayed for 2 hours.
Well, he actually had aspirations of writing classical music.
He did, indeed.
Yes.
Perhaps he still does, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess he does. There are some things that come out. Tell us a little bit about John Tavener.
He wrote,
what is it, The Protecting Veil?
That's
at
right.
Grammy, I believe. And,
nominated.
Kind of. Was that for you?
Yes, it was indeed. Yes, John Tavener, well, depends what you want to know about him. He's very tall. He's very, presents himself in this extraordinary image, which, you know, when you know somebody, some of my friends are, you know, pretty famous, and when I see how other people see them through media, it's very curious when you know the reality.
Which is?
Well, like John, for instance, he's kind of thought of, I suppose, by some people as a kind of spiritual guru, and he's not at all. I mean, not that he's not. He is very religious, and his music, I think, is extremely beautiful.
By
it is. It's definitely inspired by the music of the Orthodox Church. But then, you know, he has a kind of bitchy sense of humor, which I have to say I enjoy, and he's a normal being.
Normal person, yeah.
And I know his daughters are terribly sweet.
Now, how come he wrote this for you?
That actually was, it was the time, another time where my career just was going nowhere, just looking. There was a period in my diary, I was looking at it, I was just getting snow blindness looking at it, and I thought, what I really need there is a big project that I can really, you know, something big, I've got time, I can learn something new. So I called up John Tavener's then publisher, whom I knew, and said, I've just heard very good things. I have two sisters who are both musicians.
Yes.
And one of them's a violinist, Rachel. And she told me that I would really like John's music. And I said, do you think John Tavener would ever write anything for cello? And she said, well, why don't you call him up and ask him? He'll sound drunk, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he is. So I called up, and this extraordinary person answers, hello. And I said, well, hello, John, this is Stephen Isserlis. I'm a cellist, and I think your publisher may have told me about you.
Yeah, she did.
And I said, well, I just wondered, might you be interested in writing anything for cello?
What sort of thing?
And I said, well, I know you love the music of the Russian Orthodox Church. And so do I, you know, especially the Znamenny chant, which is, you know, the period.
Yeah, you like that, do you?
And so we went on. And in fact, I just picked up, I'd looked somewhere. It's true, absolutely true, that I always loved Russian Orthodox music, but I couldn't tell the Znamenny chant from a, you know,
right,
Popeye chant.
Right.
So I was slightly laying it on there, trying to impress him, but it worked.
And oh, it then does. Yes, it was impressive.
I said, could you write maybe a 10-minute piece for cello and very small string orchestra? Yeah, as maybe. And a few weeks later, a 40-minute piece for cello and enormous string orchestra arrived through on my doorstep.
My goodness.
And that was the protecting veil.
And what is the protecting veil?
Well, it's a 40-minute piece, a lot of it very slow.
But what is it? What is
the protecting veil is a feast where the Mother of God appeared to the Orthodox beleaguered Greeks and appeared to spread her veil over them to protect them.
To protect them.
And that's why. And he finished the piece on the eve of that feast. So that's why it's called the protecting veil.
Stephen Itterlis will be appearing at the Kimmel Center in recital on April 13th with pianist Stephen Huff. In a recent phone conversation, we spoke about his performing with someone whom he considers to be a dear friend and what they'll be playing on the program.
We will be playing both the Brahms sonatas and then three Czech pieces from different eras, different centuries. Well, no, not different centuries, but different eras. The early 19th century Hummel variations.
Yes.
Late 19th century piece by Josef Suk. And then 20th century piece by Bohuslav Martinu.
Now, the cello sonatas, did you record that with Stephen Huff as yet? I know you had plans for doing that.
No, that's planned for next month.
That's planned.
This is the pre-recording tour.
Okay. And you are very, very good friends, of course.
He is one of my very best friends, yes. He's like family.
So is this part of a tour, or is this a special...
Yeah, it's a very whirlwind tour. I'm only coming out to the States on Sunday. We've got concerts on the East and West Coast, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then we both come home. So it's a very busy little tour.
We have a recording here at the station of you doing something with Stephen Huff by Strauss.
Oh, yes.
The Sonata for Cello and Piano in F Major, yes.
Don Quixote.
Yes.
Recorded it for BMG.
I see. Uh-huh.
And, yes, no, he's, as I say, his honorary family. My son has appointed him his honorary guardian.
Oh, lucky him. I mean, lucky your son and lucky Stephen.
I know. We're first of all friends, and then it kind of spills into music. That's how we were actually introduced, because we were formerly with the same record label, Virgin Classics. We were a bit suspicious of each other, because it seemed a bit artificial. And then we started just becoming better and better friends. And now it's actually very difficult to get dates to play together, because times were both free. Like this tour, you know, had to be squeezed into a week, really. But we just, in London, we see each other all the time.
How does that feel? I mean, you must have certain opinions, each of you, when you're working together.
Yeah, we do, but we're kind of on the same wavelength. We're very different in every way, really. But it seems to be complementary. I mean, I've had better times with him, I think, than with almost any musician I've ever played with. We actually had to leave the stage once.
Were you laughing?
In Australia, we were laughing so much. That was shocking. It was also, actually, I've still got the tape. It's very, very funny. The audience luckily enjoyed it.
Well, that's an inside joke somewhere, huh?
Well, it was quite an outside joke, actually. Well, for some reason, Stephen, in the encore, grabbed the white cloth, which he uses to wipe the keyboard, and put it on his head. It was a moment of madness, but I wondered why, looking at the audience, I wondered why they suddenly started laughing so much. And then I looked around and completely lost it, and so did he. We both had just tears streaming down our cheeks, and we had to finish and go off the stage.
Well,
the audience was very understanding.
I think it's great. I think that's wonderful. So you're good friends, and you're good musicians, and you make beautiful music together. And we look forward to hearing you again.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to coming back to Philadelphia. It's great to come somewhere twice in one season.
Because
the more you come to a place, the more friends you make.
And, of course, I'm sure that that your future plans for this disc will be exciting as well, to work on the Brahms cello sonatas. How many are there?
Two. Just the two. And it's actually the first record I ever made with Brahms cello sonatas for the same label, Hyperion. So I thought it was time to revisit it.
Yes, Hyperion has a very extensive roster of wonderful, wonderful pianists. And I know that as a fact. So we will add to that a wonderful cellist as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen.
Being a pleasure.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.